houses of faith can be powerful agents and actors and anchors, really, in furthering food security in their local community in ways that go beyond food charity. We are not feeding the needy. We are organizing the hungry. Houses of faith are valuable because you have organized people, you have organized assets, money, land, kitchens, classrooms. They go largely underutilized Monday through Saturday. You can take what local communities already have in their hands, whether urban or rural, what they already have in their faith communities and say, how can we use this to help our community? So if you're listening now and you are a member of some house of faith, consider having conversations with others in your congregation, whether a temple or a mosque, a synagogue, church, and talk about the possibilities of doing something. Perhaps think about connecting with the garden ministry of a church, because you can agree on gardening, even if you have differences on faith. Or some other organization that has a group of people already professing, at least, to have concern for health, for the planet, for food as well. And
it's time for conversations about our food and how it's grown on Farm to Table Talk with your host, Roger Wasson.
There's a lot of good reasons to paying attention to growing food in urban communities, and a lot of people get motivated to jump in there and make things better for a variety of reasons. And today, I'm happy to welcome Pastor Heber Brown. Pastor Brown, sure happy to have you on Farm to Table Talk, because we're going to talk about one of my favorite subjects, and that is helping people with food and helping them grow it and eat it, distribute it, care about it, and make people healthier. And you're right in the middle of all that, Pastor Brown.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for inviting me. And I'm excited to talk about one of my favorite things to think about and talk about as well.
Yeah. Well, now, you're Pastor Brown. Now, are you still actively with a church, or is you got a broader ministry these days?
It's a little bit of both. So I'm grateful now to be serving alongside my father at my home church, the Shiloh Baptist Church here in Baltimore, Maryland. I'm serving in kind of an assistant role to him. He's the senior pastor, and that gives me the room that I need to continue pastoring this national network of congregations and farmers and other food justice stakeholders across the country, for which I'm very grateful.
You know, you don't hear about that very often. The pastor's kids kind of following in the same footsteps. You actually sometimes hear the opposite. I mean, somebody explains, well, what are they acting like that? And they said, well, you know, they're a pastor's kid.
I'm grateful to come from a lineage of pastors, and fortunate to say that everything that I've seen from my father, my grandfather, uncles and aunts, who many of them are pastors just like my dad, they presented very well in terms of what this vocation could be and the service that it could give, not even just to congregations, but to those outside the church as well. So it made me run toward it as opposed to running away from it.
Well, and as you did that, then beyond what people often think about in farm or in churches and what the responsibilities are and the messages you're sharing and working with the community, how did food get on the perspective? How did growing food or consuming or distributing food seem to be part of your mission?
Yeah, well, for nearly 14 years, I served another Baptist church here in Baltimore. And in my capacity as pastor, I witnessed a pattern of many of those members being hospitalized over and over again. And I just got curious as to what was causing my members to be hospitalized so consistently. And so engaging them in conversation, I learned that no matter the malady that they were going through, diet was in some ways a part of what it was that was causing them to be hospitalized or not at their best physically. And so once I learned that diet was in the picture, I was inspired. I really feel like I had an epiphany. God gave me a vision to start growing food on the land that the church already owned. Mm-hmm. While there were fresh food markets nearby to our church, we were priced out of making those markets a part of our regular market and grocery shopping kind of routine. And so because of those economic barriers, and frankly, because of some cultural disconnects, even at those spaces and places, it just made more sense for us, made more sense for me to lead an effort where we took the little bit of land that we had and started a garden so that we can gain access to the food that we needed.
Now, then, would you consider the area that you're in, would there be food deserts? Is what would be considered food deserts anymore? Or was it more just a matter of, is it cost was the biggest barrier?
Yeah, when we first started, I certainly was describing the dynamic as a food desert dynamic in our community. But as I continued in this work and sat at the feet of so many others who've been doing it long before me, I realized that there were some limitations to the term food desert that caused some blind spots to other factors that were causing this situation to be someone that we experienced. And so we use a term that actually is a little bit heavier now, food apartheid. It's a heavier term, but apartheid simply is a word that means separateness. And with that term and with this phrase, what we're pointing to is the ways that not only economics, but other aspects and factors also create these dynamics, like zoning, like the redlining maps of the Homeowners Loan Corporation of 1933, and so many more. And so when you look at the historically redlined communities of the nation, many of them are places where not only do you have difficulty finding nutrient-rich food, but you also can find challenges around quality jobs with living wages, quality schools. And so the food desert terminology became too narrow. As our analysis of the situation became more broad, we realized we were up against something much bigger than just, oh, we don't have grocery stores. It's much bigger than that. And so we now describe it as food apartheid. And with that kind of analysis, we are better able to understand how we got here in the first place. And my view is, you can't really understand where you're going until you understand where you've been. And so that analysis of how we got here is important.
Well, so you start off recognizing that there were health issues. Then you could come to a conclusion that the community could kind of have food as medicine. Yeah. And then you also get to a stage that you're looking, there's a resource available. If you're a church, you got at least a yard probably, you know what, and some have got more than that. So you right off the bat, if you get enough people to work on it, they can grow food. So I'm kind of with you there. And so you got that much of a vision. So how do you convince people that they ought to give up their Saturday or something and come over and dig around in the garden, do hard work and produce fruits and vegetables for the community?
Well, you know, it wasn't hard, Roger. For one, many of the members of my congregation were African Americans who moved north during the Great Migration. Mm-hmm. But prior to coming north, they lived down south in a more agrarian society, a more agrarian time in the nation. And many of them grew up on farms with 8, 9, or 10 brothers and sisters. And so it wasn't strange or foreign territory. When I raised this vision of us growing food, it actually took them back to their upbringing. And many of them were super excited because it allowed them to utilize skills that they already learned years ago and tap into an aspect of living and rhythm of life that would contribute to their mental and psychological and physical health all at the same time. I learned through them, the elders, the seniors of my church, that though they left the farm during the Great Migration, the farm never left them. It was still very present to their minds and still to their practices as well.
Yeah. Well, I want to skip ahead just a little bit and look how much broader you've got, because you had that vision started with your church. And how many church communities are involved with you now?
Yeah, in 2015, we started with our one church. And now in 2024, we have nearly 250 congregations across the United States of all denominations and all sizes as well.
So do you have to give them some coaching and say, okay, now here's how you go about doing it? Because I would imagine that it wouldn't take long at all for people to say, well, this seems like a good idea, but I don't know, I don't have a clue how to get started. So do they have to, do you have to jump in and give them training to say, okay, this is the way you do it?
You're absolutely right. We help them by providing virtual workshops, in-person workshops, connect them with resources right in their community that they did not know about before, like the local extension office, land grant universities, and so many other groups that already exist. And so sometimes I feel like a people pollinator because I'm just connecting the dots between people and groups and organizations that live in the same neighborhood but just don't know each other.
I talked to somebody that was doing some similar program out in Richmond, California, just there in the San Francisco Bay. And I had a good visit with them. But one of the things that they were doing were helping some formerly incarcerated individuals come back and find some purpose to how they can kind of get back into society. And so they really had open arms for people that had spent some time incarcerated. And when you talk to them, boy, they were really finding meaning in life and digging their hands in the soil. And so even beyond how much food or whether it's taking care of your nutritional needs, it seemed like it was satisfying something that they needed just to be engaged in that kind of work.
Oh, yeah. And that's a story that I hear across the nation as well as we interface with various organizations and people and congregations in our network. The benefits of getting closer to soil and growing at least some of your own food or growing food for others go far beyond just physical benefits.
Yeah.
The mental and emotional benefits of that also, we've seen it to be a great, great thing for people who participate with our programming. I'm just glad science is catching up to explaining some of this, because I've seen research now that suggests that what we've kind of known intuitively and known in our gut, the science is saying, yeah, this improves mental outlook. It improves emotional health. It improves kind of these social connections in a neighborhood. And this is what the old folks of our families and communities long knew from their own lived experience. And now science is helping to back it up and say, this is the real deal.
So you in Maryland, you're kind of the north edge of the South. And so I wonder whether some of the foods that were more likely grown in the South before the migration of people moving north and so forth are a little easier maybe to grow in Maryland. I don't even know what they all are, except I've got a soul food restaurant here in town I go to and I order everything I can and see. But I do see there's vegetables that were part of a tradition. And I'm just curious whether you find a way to incorporate some of those things into what you're growing.
Absolutely. I mean, our congregants, the members of our member churches, they bring that stuff with them in terms of that knowledge, that insight, and various foods. There's a lot of overlap here in the Mid-Atlantic. You're right. We're at the tip of the top of the South, and we're at the bottom of the tip of the North. And so we're kind of the belly button of the East Coast, so to speak. And we're able to draw from the best wisdom, recipes, and food items from both the North and the South right here in the middle.
You know, I went down to Harlem one time and I got a tour because there was a program and they were taking some of the produce that they were growing both in the gardens, and then some were coming from upstate New York. They were bringing down and they were distributing them. And one of the things that just struck me as genius is that they started every time they set up like a Saturday at a school or somewhere, there's going to be these vegetables offered at a church. But they started making sure that they had a slow cooker of something showing what you could do with it.
Because
You know, a lot of these people that I know, like California cuisine, saying, oh, have you tasted a carrot grown this way? Well, I have, and I don't like a carrot that just don't plain old carrot. You know, I want it in a pot roast or something with onions and everything. And so when I feel like I can't confess to it, because when they say, you know, kids just haven't tasted the carrot, and I think, well, maybe they have, you know. And so what I really liked of what they were doing in this program in Harlem is that when they had the day for it, they'd have a pot cooking, simmering of some like soup or some other thing with some stock with the vegetables. And people could not only pick up some vegetables that they could take home, but they get a recipe and say, here, now taste this. See how easy this was that we did this, and you can do it too. And I thought, well, that was just genius. I don't know why I haven't heard more people doing that.
Roger, I'm going to go ahead and confess with you that though I am now a farmer and a preacher and grow food, and I'm grateful to grow a whole lot of stuff, everything I grow, I don't want to eat. So I'm just going to be honest with you. Let's go ahead and have confession. It's good for your soul. And I think those who are out kind of preaching that message of eat it, it's healthy, sometimes they become so zealous about the nutritional side of it that they overlook that we have a deep relationship with food. It has to be good too. It has to taste good too.
That's right.
And
Get yourself a roast and stick it in a slow cooker, and then dump every vegetable you can think of in there and leave
there
it on for about 8 or 9 hours, and you could eat off of that for about 4 days.
I've done it. Yeah. You know, I grew up with my great grandmother doing, you know, slow cookers and the crock pot, as she used to call it. And now at this stage and age of life, I started doing it myself. And Roger, you're right. Throw it all in there and you can eat for most of your week. And so I love that kind of thing. We conduct food demonstrations at our markets and other events as well, similar to what you shared, because when people taste it for themselves, oftentimes they can be inspired to incorporate something new to their regular routine. So it's really a good thing to bring that slow cooker or bring that pan and try to gives people a little bit of sample of it.
You know, and then one more tangent I'm going to jump on, and that is that when we have so much emphasis on fresh food, well, unfortunately, some are just a limited period of time.
And that's right.
And one of the mistakes I see is that so many of these programs they go overboard saying we need to eat lots and lots of fresh food. Well, fine. But for most of the country, fresh is 3 months long.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I saw a program in New York where they were starting to help people preserve and do canning and freezing and drying, and so that you could stretch out the whole season and get that healthy food year round, not just at the peak. Have you ever heard
of that? There's definitely some. We got to be real. I mean, we don't have to pretend as if the healthy food movement or the farm movement fixes all the problems of the world. Let's just be honest about what is and what isn't. And what you say is very true in terms of being sensitive to the various seasons. And I believe that climate change is going to impact that even more in terms of when foods are available. One of the things that I like to do with congregations is talk about what it is to eat in season. Yeah. The grocery stores sometimes present this illusion as if all foods are available at any time of the year. But I tell our congregations here in Maryland, you're not supposed to be eating watermelon in December. If it's in December, that watermelon came a long way away, and there's other impacts that might be connected to that watermelon that you might not want to be close to you. And so eating in season is good. And then you took me back to my great-grandmother again. Mama Geraldine is what we called her. She would have shelves and shelves of mason jars with preserved food in her kitchen. And we started doing, matter of fact, during the pandemic, we started doing workshops for people on how to can and preserve their food at home. And I think that's something that we're going to keep doing for a long time. It's an important science and art.
Well, when you do go to stores, too, I think that the other thing is that there's been too much pressure on telling people if they go to the store, just shop the perimeter. but you can buy canned diced tomatoes and you can buy frozen blueberries and things that are preserved and, you know, different dried fruits and nuts and so forth. And you don't have to be buying that expensive perimeter that had to be shipped from Chile in the middle of the winter.
Right. Exactly right.
Yeah. Well, obviously I can get excited about this. You're doing really good work. Now, are you able to get any grants or support from other programs to help you carry out this work?
Absolutely. We're so grateful. We have a small list of family foundations who see the vision and have a commitment to farming and food justice and food security as well. So we're thankful for the ways that we have been supported. And of course, there's always room for more. And so if anybody's listening, please call me. But yeah. I'm grateful for not only the foundations, but also more and more, we're inviting our member churches and other congregations to also chip in to help this thing grow. As you know, many faith communities of various religious tradition have some line item in the budget that has to do with outreach, some great cause in society that they're contributing to. And sometimes these efforts are halfway around the world, and that's all fine and good. But I just want to make sure that our religious groups also consider the local farmers in your community. Sure. And the food-based organizations who are doing great work in the neighborhood that could also stand to use some support from the local houses of faith as well.
You know, it's a good time to plug your website address. So the people want to chase you down. Where do they find you?
Absolutely. You can go to blackchurchfoodsecurity.net. Again, that's blackchurchfoodsecurity.net.
And then from there, they can learn all about the program and ways that they figure out how they could be able to contribute to them.
Yep. Contribute, volunteer, find where we are in the country. All the information is right there. We'd love to. And sign up for our newsletter, which during spring and summer goes out twice a month. I'll give you reports from the road as I'm going around organizing and farming and introducing you to people who are doing great work in their local communities as well.
You know, that brings up another area that I've wondered about, and that is animals. Because some places you can have chickens, and man, those chickens, you know, just go out and get an egg every day and all the nutrition if you can get chickens. Now, are you able to have chickens in Baltimore?
Yes, there's a certain number. I believe it's about 5. No roosters are allowed in the city, but chickens, sure. Chickens are. And even beyond our home city of Baltimore, in our other member churches in other parts of the nation, they can get chickens. And some of our churches now do have chicken coops on their land, and their members take advantage of the eggs that come along with that. So that's really exciting. That's a thing that's happening in our network right now.
I think the next frontier might end up being goats, but that might be a step too far for a lot of cities. But boy, there's a lot of places that could use it. I mean, I imagine in Baltimore, a lot of the other cities you're in, there's places that can just get cleaned up with goats that you can. And I was talking to somebody yesterday that was saying in the sheep industry, lambs and goats, they're just all sorts, especially in the Northeast, of expanding demand for local consumption. And a lot of that are people of the Middle Eastern that have moved to Northeastern United States that are from countries where their habits were having goats and lamb and so yeah. forth. And they're purchasing tremendous quantities that they're getting one or two at a time, not going through the normal channels necessarily. And there are people driving out to Pennsylvania, going back into Baltimore, back into New York, back into Washington, D.C., and selling a lamb or two, a goat or two. And it's not one of those things that makes the headlines, but it's happening, and it's reflecting, you know, traditions that they're finding unique and innovative ways to fill their need.
Yeah, I've not heard about that as much, but I'm excited to, and thank you for sharing it. You make me think about the fact that as people immigrate and come to this country, it's not just a person, right? It's a person, okay. And their food ways and their, yeah. their diet, their recipes, their all that's coming too. And I think it's contributing a whole lot to what American cuisine will mean in the years to come.
Yeah. Yeah. And you just have to go with it. It's tricky for people to kind of put this into perspective because everyone wants to see a food system that's kind of tidy and, right. You know, and they get it. And it just isn't tidy. But, no. You know, and that brings up one other one. You're going to think I just have a big old list of things I was just going to keep bringing up, but I've got one other one that I've noticed. I saw somebody did a program in an area that was pretty low income. And they ended up, they were trying to push, you know, fruits and vegetables and so forth and produce, but they found that they were getting pushback because they had been, the community had been told so much that they had to have certified organic. And they thought, well, I can't afford organic, so why even bother? And it absolutely, this was in the south side of Chicago, and it actually backfired. That a whole community started to form an opinion that there's no reason for them to try to consume more fruits and vegetables because the only good fruits and vegetables were those that were certified organic and those were too costly. I thought, oh wow, something went wrong there.
Yeah, the you make me think about why we commit so much to our organization to education. Mm-hmm. So we don't just, you know, if a church reaches out to us and they say, hey, we want to start a garden, we don't just say, okay, let's get going. We actually invite them to come sit down and come to class. We got to learn together before the first seed is planted in the soil. And I know that's the part that people get really excited about. We really got to pause, take a moment, study the corporate food system as it exists today, study things about the environment, study climate change, and study the nature of our relationships with our neighbors. And so my background is in community organizing and even before pastoring, I was a community organizer. And I know that that part of our work is crucial because of things like what you just said. You know, you like that, if you let that seed of a kind of a disagreement or a misunderstanding, even with respect to food and certified or not, if you let that grow, it can grow to the place where it shuts down your whole operation and you won't know what hits you. And so I think it's really important. To really slow down sometimes and let's sit and talk together. Let's learn together. Let's study where we've been, analyze where we are, and then dream together in terms of where we can go.
Well, and I totally agree with that. And I also think, too, that it's easy for people to get swept away with what's going on in social media and the broad generalizations like you should only eat fresh and you should only eat vegetables or you should only eat, you know, things that weren't frozen. And you know, all those only do this, only do that. It just makes it more and more restrictive and more difficult for people to just, enjoy growing and being nurtured by good food.
Yeah. One of the greatest things I did over the past year is log off social media. I've been off writing a book right now, and I needed to focus and not have distraction. And I've noticed my quality of life has improved in some key ways just because I'm not in the fray of the back and forth of the online debates and discussions as much as I used to be.
I'm almost there. I've got a couple.
Yeah.
And I hate to admit it.
I'm going back on because I got to sell a book, but I'm going to be guarding and monitoring how I engage because sometimes we major in the minors and minor in the majors.
How do you really go from hearing this idea and saying, gee, I think this makes some sense and I'd like to help?
Yeah. So I would say this, and again, I'll share my organization website in a second, but I'm just as much helping to scale the idea of this as much as I'm trying to scale an organization. The idea is spreading that houses of faith can be powerful agents and actors and anchors, really, in furthering food security in their local community in ways that go beyond food charity. People are used to churches, for example, giving out food to those who are hungry. But one of the things that we love to say in our organization is that we are not feeding the needy. We are organizing the hungry. That is our charge because we have a shared experience. We have a shared pain point. And when we can recognize that our pain point is a common and shared one, then we can also imagine and dream of ways to work together to transform the underlying dynamics that have us hungry in the first place. So I would like to invite people, whether they are religious or not. I'm not, you know, trying to invite you to come to church every Sunday or join the local church if that's not where you are. But from a socio-political standpoint, and I'm not talking about politics in terms of D's and R's, but politics in terms of populace, in a socio-political standpoint, faith, houses of faith are valuable because you have organized people, you have organized assets, money, land, kitchens, classrooms. They go largely underutilized Monday through Saturday. And if you have an asset-based community development mentality, you can take what local communities already have in their hands, whether urban or rural, what they already have in their faith communities and say, how can we use this to help our community in a way that aligns with our faith commitments, but even beyond that, aligns with our commitment to advancing the social good. So if you're listening now and you are a member of some house of faith, consider having conversations with others in your congregation, whether a temple or a mosque, a synagogue, church, and talk about the possibilities of doing something. I would advise people not to jump into the deep end. You heard Roger talk about the broad fork. It'll sit you down quick. But maybe start with a little, putting a seed in a little cup. Y'all remember those little activities. Do something like that just to start nurturing the idea in your faith community. And if you're not a religious person, perhaps think about connecting with the garden ministry of a church. Because you can agree on gardening, even if you have differences on faith, or some other organization that has a group of people already professing, at least, to have concern for health, for the planet, for food as well, and farmers.
Yeah, it's a great story. And one quick thing to add to just what you said, and that is I'm also aware of churches that find other churches that will give the space because that church is in an urban church, but they say they want to do this. And they knew some other church where they had people were getting up there in age and they didn't want to go out and do the work. And they'd say, well, we'll let you use it. And the other one I've seen is vacated schools because there's been so many school grounds that have been consolidated and closed, I think, pretty much across the country. And you sometimes have 4 or 5 acres of an abandoned baseball diamond and things like that, that I know a few different spots where they've been able to go in and take an abandoned school and the city let them develop it as a community garden.
That's right. You hit the nail on the head, Roger. There's so many possibilities right under our nose. It just takes people who are willing to think imaginatively and creatively about how we can use what we already have right in our hands.
Well, I'm excited. I like what you're doing. I hope some of the folks listening to this will, if they don't get in touch with you directly, I think you've touched somebody that's going to say, gee, I heard this on Farm to Table Talk, and Pastor Brown's got a good idea. I'm going to see how I can move that direction. So I think
I hope so.
Good. That's what pastors do. So you did it.
Oh, thank you.
Appreciate it.
Thanks, Roger.
Thanks for being on Farm to Table Talk.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
You've been listening to Farm to Table Talk with your host, Roger Wasson.